from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, new studies suggest less frequent screening for breast or prostate cancer is creating a divide among doctors and epidemiologists, with some recommending yearly screenings to detect early-stage cancers and others taking the position that too much screening can increase false positives and cause harm. We'll take the issue up in the hour ahead. We'll include your calls, emails, and online questions and comments. That's next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. During this month of breast cancer awareness, controversy has once again emerged over the advisability of mammography and also over prostate screenings. An estimated $20 billion is spent to screen breast and prostate cancer, despite the fact that PSA or prostate testing in the United States in the mid-1980s, along with intensive screening, did not produce appreciably different results in prostate cancer differences between here and the United Kingdom, where intensive screening was not adopted. Recommendations from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force have urged healthy men not to undergo screening for prostate cancer, and new research also challenges the efficacy of breast cancer screening. We take up the issue in this morning's opening Forum Hour. Joining us from Boston is Richard Knox, correspondent for the Science Desk of National Public Radio, and we welcome you, Richard Knox. Good to have you.
Thanks very much.
Let's begin by helping us, if you would, kindly sort this out. We're getting kind of mixed signals here, aren't we, from different sources?
Yeah, I think it's very confusing. It's very difficult for both doctors and patients to understand some of these recommendations. It was almost 2 years ago that the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force made the controversial recommendation that women under 50 don't have to have annual mammograms. And just this week, there was another study that kind of added some fuel to that fire out of UCSF in your territory, suggesting that women who have annual mammograms of any age over, say, a 10-year period would have a 60% chance of getting a false positive and having an unnecessary biopsy. That the unnecessary biopsy risk would be around 7%. So that's, you know, that underscores the problem that the task force is talking about. You have to be careful with these tests because they can sometimes lead to bad things as well as good things, namely finding an early cancer. The recent U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendation, the same group on prostate cancer, says that healthy men don't need to have regular PSAs, which, you know, contradicts a long dogma about what should be part of every man's annual checkup. So it's really tough to explain why these experts are coming to these conclusions.
It's almost kind of a shift in many ways because for a long time we were told by ads and by public education campaigns that mammography and PSAs save lives.
Yes, well, I think the fundamental difficulty is that it should be intuitively obvious that detecting cancer early is better. But in fact, the research is saying not necessarily. It depends on the cancer. It depends on you know, whether it's an aggressive cancer or not. And we can't really know when a man has a higher PSA, A, whether it really is cancer, and B, whether it's going to be a cancer that needs aggressive treatment. With mammography, there's no question that it has saved lives to find early breast cancers. But there's also no question that many women have mammograms that fail to find cancer, an aggressive cancer. And so, you know, these tests are not perfect. We have to sort of understand the flaws in the test in order to use them correctly.
Well, I'm looking at some statistics and numbers which are certainly disconcerting and shed a good deal of light on this. Breast cancer, for every life that's saved through screening, 5 to 15 are overdiagnosed. And in terms of prostate cancer, the number goes up to 30 to 100. And there's even more, not only overdiagnosis, but also a higher risk of complications from treatment with prostate cancer.
Yes, it's very hard once a prostate cancer is found to say, let's just watch it, which is really what a lot of experts in the field are saying many men ought to do. They used to call it watchful waiting. Now they're talking about it as active surveillance. Many people are very uncomfortable, doctors and patients, with letting any cancer be watched. But the fact is that a very high proportion of men who get treated for prostate cancer have side effects. They have incontinence of bladder and bowel sometimes, and they have impotence often. And, you know, their lives are changed forever. And sometimes this wouldn't really have been necessary if a man has what's called an indolent cancer, one that's not really going to be growing very fast. It can be, you know, watched and monitored with biopsies and PSA tests. But that's not the American way, at least not yet.
We're talking again with Richard Knox, who's with us from Boston. He's correspondent with the Science Desk of National Public Radio. And finally, I guess what it comes down to, Richard Knox, maybe is there's no single right answer. It's a little bit as someone said, like going into a casino. I mean, you have to have as many facts as you can, but it's ultimately really a gamble.
It is a gamble, and I think that's really a useful way of looking at it, because everybody has a different tolerance for risk. Some people would like to take the gamble and not have the test, and some people would like to take the gamble and have the test and then gamble on whether to get treated or not. You have to play the odds. There are trade-offs with these tests, and we need to understand the trade-offs. It's a big problem with American medicine, and I think we're going to have a lot of these issues over the coming years, because we're engaged in this big national debate about how much can we afford and how can we keep costs under control and can we extend access to everybody. And these technologies come along and they look good, but then we often discover that there are downsides, and we need to understand those downsides and be able to pull back if we've been too aggressive with a given technology. That's hard to do.
Richard Knox, again, correspondent with the Science Desk of National Public Radio. And Richard Knox, thank you for joining us on Forum this morning.
Sure, anytime. Enjoyed it.
Enjoyed having you and appreciate your being with us. Let me tell you who's with us for the hour. Susan Kuttner is chair of the Kaiser Permanente Northern California Breast Care Task Force, also chairs the Interregional Breast Care Leaders Group. She is a surgeon, an MD, and she's here in studio with us. Welcome. Good morning.
Thank you.
Jeff Belcora, also with us, PhD, assistant professor in the Department of Surgery and Institute for Health Policy Studies and director of Decision Services Unit with the Breast Cancer Center at UCSF. Welcome.
Thank you.
And with us by phone from Stanford this morning is Mark Gonzalgo, who is associate professor of urology at the Stanford University School of Medicine, MD. Welcome, Dr. Gonzalgo.
Michael, thank you for having me.
Good to have you. Susan Kuttner, let me begin with you. So much of this is, as I was kind of trying to intimate before, a need to really educate the public and get the public versed in what's going on. We just heard from Richard Knox, there's been new research out of UCSF where Dr. Belcora is. What are we learning at this point that's moving us forward in terms of really decision-making for the public?
Well, I think that one of the things that this study has done is really supported a lot of the evidence that we've been collecting before. Mammography is still the best screening tool for breast cancer. We still know that at age 50 to 69, that it decreases the mortality because we are able to diagnose breast cancer at an early stage. Once again, we need to continue to look at the evidence, and at Kaiser Permanente, we do similar reviews on every 2 years of all the evidence. And this evidence really shows that every year, annual screening may not be necessary. Every X-ray has its own risk, because we have a lifetime risk from all the X-rays we receive, and that's not only mammography nowadays. So that we need to know what's the benefit to each individual. So we can have a set of guidelines around mammography that tell us what's the benefit at what age group. And remember, 50 is only a metaphor for when menopause usually occurs. It's not the magic age. But it really is to individualize each person's care. So it's taking what we know from the guidelines, creating a public policy around what's the best evidence for a population, and then, as we try to do it at Kaiser, is to individualize each woman's set of preventative recommendations, and certainly for PSA, similar process, that would really help encourage them to have screening at what's appropriate for their risk factors, for their previous physical examinations, and for their own sense of risk that was mentioned before by Richard Knox, which I think is a very important part, what each individual feels is best for them.
So it is really almost case by case.
Absolutely. It's a general recommendation, but it really needs to be personalized. That's what the information is telling us.
What about more effective methods? What I'm thinking about, for example, is maybe the idea of customizing breast screening to involve not only age and breast density, but family health history, all of that being seen from an individual level. And getting a better gestalt of what each individual needs.
That's absolutely what's needed, because it really is not one size fits all for any kind of screening, but particularly for mammography. And that's really, when do you start screening for mammograms? You need to consider a family history. You need to consider the breast exam. You need to consider what a previous mammogram tells you about the value of mammography. Mammography is not a perfect tool, but it is the best screening tool we have. And so we need to use that wisely and make sure that every woman understands why they're having their mammograms and at what frequency, not that we have a generalized rule that everyone has to have them at what age and at what frequency, but we can tell them what the value added is. That's what this information is telling us. It's not telling us to reject mammography. And it's not telling us that mammography prevents breast cancer. That's one of the things that we need to know, is these are screening tools. We can't rely on them. We need to develop better tools. And that's one of the things that we continue to work on as we use the tools that we have, such as mammography.
Susan Kuttner again with us in studio, chairs Kaiser Permanente's Northern California Breast Care Task Force and is chair of the Interregional Breast Care Leaders Group, and Jeff Belcora is assistant professor in the Department of Surgery and Institute for Health Policy Studies, also directs Decision Services Unit, Breast Cancer Breast Care Center at UCSF. Jeff, you, I know, are pretty strongly advocating patients and doctors work together in this individual basis that we just heard from Dr. Kuttner. And that means more really onus on the patient, doesn't it? More responsibility.
Yeah, and I think that's, patients have – people, individuals have a kind of a concerned reaction to conflicting messages in the media, and properly so. I would say that all of us need to be really pretty skeptical about the messages that come to us, even from scientists, because knowledge is a moving target. So years ago, people thought hormone replacement therapy would be a healthy thing for a woman of about this age, and that turned out not to be so. And years ago, scientists thought that driving fat out of the diet would be healthy, and now it's turning out not to be so for certain kinds of fat, et cetera. So I would say skepticism is always a healthy thing.
And as you suggest, everything's in flux.
Everything's in flux. Yeah. So I think we ought to be excited about these studies in terms of the progress they represent. And each of us, as Richard Knox was saying, each of us has our own feelings and risk attitudes and tolerances for risk, and that's the way it really should be. That's the way it is in all of life. There's no kind of easy answers or magic answers. So I think people are a little chagrined that, oh no, you mean I have to actually educate myself on this, and I can't just kind of coast on the wisdom of my doctor and on the wisdom of scientists. And that's right. You are the primary stakeholder. It's your life that's at stake.
But
in
even
this
when you educate yourself, sometimes, as we've been indicating, the messages come in conflict with one another. I was just looking at the University of Massachusetts study. It says women around 25 should have mammography, particularly if there's a possibility of genetic link to breast cancer. And there's been this, as Dr. Kuttner said, this kind of broadside notion that any women over 50 because of menopause should have mammograms. And then we get research which says, hey, mammograms don't really do a lot, or they're not necessary.
So I would say that a lot of the times scientists are quibbling over fairly small effects, and the large effects or the major issues are still available to consumers through devices and materials known as decision aids, which can be used in consultation, obviously, with your physician to really understand what is the absolute benefit. For example, I think women in their 40s are sometimes surprised to hear that the absolute benefit of being in a screening program for 10 years is about equivalent to driving about 300 miles less every year. So there is a benefit. There is also the possibility of harm. And I think the harm is sometimes felt to be like, well, if we're talking about saving somebody's life, you know, some bother and some hassle and inconvenience is not really much of a price to pay. But I wonder if I can read you an email I got from a patient about the kinds of harm that they felt through a screening mammogram that was done at 40 and resulted in really no finding of cancer. So the email just says, "Today I came to the end of a nightmare that began after I had my first ever mammogram. The radiologist spotted some calcifications that were in a highly suspicious pattern. I was recommended for a stereoscopic needle biopsy, and you all recall my love for needles, right? Which failed. At that point, I was scheduled for surgery, which I got last Thursday with full anesthesia and the whole works. It was a two-part process where they inserted a needle in my breast, first when I was awake to mark the location for the surgeon, and then an hour later I had the surgery. It has been a miserable few weeks obsessing about worst-case scenarios."
Well, a cautionary tale. Thank you for that. Let me bring Mark Gonzago into this discussion. He's associate professor of urology at Stanford University School of Medicine. We're getting conflicting messages on prostate cancer too, aren't we, Mark?
Certainly, Michael. And I think that the decision to proceed with PSA testing or screening is very complex. And I really need to caution folks in terms of trying to overinterpret some of the statements made most recently and certainly controversially by the U.S. Preventive Task Force. If you look at the data, prostate cancer is still the most commonly diagnosed cancer and the second leading cause of cancer deaths among American men. If you look before the era of PSA testing, before the 1990s, two-thirds of men who were diagnosed with prostate cancer actually had advanced disease, and many of these men were, in fact, incurable. And since the introduction of PSA testing in the 1990s, prostate cancer deaths in the United States have been reduced by approximately 30%. So getting along with the theme of trying to individualize patient approach to screening, I think that the thought process really should be one of a shared decision-making approach between the physician and the patient. In fact, we see many patients coming to the clinic now with loads of information from the internet and really asking very pointed and inquisitive questions with regard to the need for PSA testing, screening, and then subsequent potential need for other testing, which may include prostate biopsy, surgery, or radiation.
What do you make of Otis Brawley, head of the American Cancer Society, saying that men should make not only informed decisions about prostate cancer, but also saying that that the PSAs are oversold? He kind of retreated on that a bit, but that was at least his opening remark, his opening salvo on PSAs.
Right. So, with respect to the oversold argument, the blanket approach for screening may certainly not be the most appropriate. In fact, I really am a firm believer, as well as many of my colleagues, in risk stratification. We know that for certain groups of men, with regard to age, race, or family history, that the propensity for harboring prostate cancer may, in fact, be higher than men who may be at lower risk. So, with regard to mass screenings, I think we can certainly improve our ability not only with respect to annual or deferred surveillance, i.e. increasing the amount of time between PSA testing, by using this other information, which is very easily available to us, and certainly we can share that with the patients.
Hasn't there been, though, an extraordinary number of men who've been overtreated once PSA testing in the mid-80s got intensive? And
I think there's no question that, in fact, we are in this dilemma where patients are being overtreated with a test. One of the limitations of the PSA test certainly is the limitation with respect to trying to predict what may, in fact, be life-threatening disease compared to that disease which may, in fact, be low-grade or very slow-growing. And that's where I think the role of treatments, if you will, such as active surveillance, will be able to play an increasing part of the decision-making process when we're considering different treatment options.
Again, Mark Gonzalgo is Associate Professor of Urology at the Stanford University School of Medicine. I'm going to open the phone lines now. I know there are many of you who would like to join this conversation, and I invite you to do that. Our toll-free number, if you have questions or comments, is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your call, so feel free to call us now. It's 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, email us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And you can also communicate with us with questions or comments via Facebook. I'm wondering, Susan Kuttner, just in a general sense, if we're talking about screenings as being, well, when we think about both breast cancer and prostate cancer, Laura Esserman, for example, said that many of the screen-detected cancers are slow-growing with breast cancer and really don't even need treatment, and screening won't necessarily it won't bring things to a conclusion if it's done earlier. It won't bring things to a greater sense of illumination. And so we get into this whole question of just the value of screening, don't we?
Well, I think that one of the things that we've learned, and certainly in breast cancer, we have come a long way and probably are a little bit ahead of the curve of what we're learning about prostate cancer. And that is the disease is not one set of biologies, meaning not all breast cancer acts the same, presents the same, or grows the same, so that we can't have a one-size-fits-all screening, unfortunate as that is. That's why this is an imperfect tool, but still
the public thinks
best.
Of a kind of magic bullet all-purpose screening, doesn't it?
We do, often, yeah. But I think that we're trying, at this point, what the information is telling us is that for the vast majority of people, this is a good screening tool, but for some, it's not going to be perfect. What we need to add to that is information about what if we find that you have an abnormal mammogram, such as the example that we heard from the patient that was very unhappy with having to undergo invasive procedures. So every woman undergoing a screening test needs to know, what's the impact of having a mammogram? It might be abnormal. If it's abnormal, what's the next step? If it's positive, there are different treatment programs. And in breast cancer, we have tailored many of those treatment programs to fit the nature of the disease and the nature of that patient, what their whole healthcare needs are.
But haven't there been too many biopsies? I mean, in point of fact.
There are many biopsies, and a lot of it is based on that sometimes when you look at the nature of mammography, individual radiologists tend to lean towards different value systems of reading, whether they believe personally that they want to overread things because they don't want to miss a cancer. And so we're still in that new state of flux as to what's the value added of finding something at such an early phase that, as Laura Esserman pointed out, may not become something that threatens your overall quality or quantity of life.
In fact,
we don't have predictors yet about that.
Unfortunately, we don't. But we're coming up on a break here. And Jeff Belcour, I just want to get you on record here about screening for both, you could say, increases the burden of low-risk cancers while maybe reducing the burden of the more aggressive cancers.
Yeah, so I think we also ought to define screening, that we're talking about people who are not at high risk to begin with, and it's a general population approach. And in that case, you're going to impose quite a cost on the population, the big population that you're screening, in order to find just a few cancers.
When we return, we'll bring you into it, our listeners, with your calls and emails. And again, you can reach us by phone, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org, or join us on Facebook, or post your questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. New studies suggest less frequent screening for breast or prostate cancer are revealing some divisions among physicians and epidemiologists. And one camp recommends yearly screening to detect cancers in the early stages. The other suggests that screening too frequently increases false positives and can lead to more harmful interventions than required. We're talking about the variables and Richard Knox joined us earlier, correspondent with the Science Desk for National Public Radio. Mark Gonzalo with us from Stanford, associate professor of urology in the Stanford University School of Medicine. And Susan Kuttner here in studio, chairs the Kaiser Permanente Northern California Breast Care Task Force and also chairs the Interregional Breast Care Leaders Group. She's a surgeon. Jeff Balcora, assistant professor, Department of Surgery and Institute for Health Policy Studies, director of the Decision Services Unit at the Breast Care Center in at University of California, San Francisco. And he has a blog, jeffbalcora.com/blog, which gives you decision aids for consumers to actually look at and can help you along this process of making decisions. What else in terms of that the blog can people find, Jeff?
Well, I think it's there's a couple of good books that I recommend. One of them is Should I Be Tested for Cancer? Maybe Not, and Here's Why by Gil Welch. You know, it is an individual decision, and these decision aids are really carefully packaged to put things in perspective for people so that when they go see their doctor and ask questions, as they should, that they have a view of what are the absolute risks. I mentioned a minute ago off the air that 17 out of 100 men will get prostate cancer in their lifetimes, but only three will die of it. So many more people are dying with prostate cancer than of it. And it's important to understand that from that baseline, 3 out of 100 is what we're talking about with possible improvements using PSA screening.
What about baseline, Mark Gonzalo, for prostate cancer from the perspective of those who are, well, getting up in the elderly years? I mean, they are much more prone to getting prostate cancer. And in fact, it's almost inevitable in the cases of so many elderly people, men.
Right, Michael, that's a great point, and we certainly know that age is a risk factor for harboring prostate cancer. One of the things we also need to consider is that screening in men, particularly over the age of 75, really should be considered quite on an individual basis with regard to their medical comorbidities, family history, say, of longevity. I think this is one other area of controversy within the field with respect to PSA screening for men who are really over 75. There are many who also feel that PSA testing for men over that age is not necessary. I think that one of the premises of screening is the fact that a person should be able to live longer than what would potentially happen if the disease were to cause their death. And so when we talk about prostate cancer, we typically consider a time window of at least 10 to 15 years in terms of longevity. So I think that you have to take that into consideration when you're talking about patients and their age, because we are finding many, many folks who are now living beyond 80s and into their 90s.
Many of our listeners probably know Dr. Jerome Groopman, who writes for The New Yorker, who's an oncologist, and I keep coming back in my mind to his notion that we are still in a lot of uncertain territory when it comes to medicine. Meantime, let me go to your phone calls, and let's begin, Karen, with you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm from Sacramento, and I'm 40 years old, and I was just diagnosed with invasive ductal breast cancer just 2 weeks ago. It was caught on a routine screening. And it was a real shock to me. I'm young. I have no history of breast cancer in my family. I'm a vegan. I exercise. And so I guess I just kind of wanted to put a voice to the sort of story of early cancer detection. And also, I can't help but wonder what would have happened to me if my insurance had followed these guidelines and not done a routine screening. The lump was not palpable during a self-exam or even an exam from my gynecologist. So if I had waited 10 years, where would I be?
Dr. Kuttner?
Well, you are definitely an example of why we need to individualize and personalize everyone's screening. At Kaiser, we have set out recommendations based on the review of the evidence that says we recommend screening every 1 to 2 years from age 40 to 74. That's where the greatest value is. But it really is something that needs to be available to all women. And really to have a conversation about your risk factors. And clearly, with breast cancer, 70% of all women diagnosed have no family history. And what we really are aiming for is to detect cancer before it becomes a more difficult cancer to treat. And so I think that you're a great example of why every woman needs to have that conversation, needs to be informed, and all the physicians and the insurer groups need to have that same platform of personalized care based on the best evidence. And I think it's an excellent example of why we can't throw out the screening tests that we know while we look for better tools and while we continue to advance our research that tells us who would best benefit from this.
So Karen, good luck to you. I'm glad you got it detected. Thank you for the call. Here, Jeff Belcour has a web comment. Someone writes, there was a $20 million study on thermography for early breast cancer, University of California Norris Cancer Center, saying that it was 99% effective as a negative predictive value. If anything in medicine is 99% effective and is not invasive, why is it not used more commonly? And also, is it really effective on dense breast tissue that is not as well screened by mammograms?
Yeah, that's out of my expertise. I would defer to Dr. Kuttner on that. You know, again, I would just say there are probably resources in these decision aids that would address different technologies and their benefits. But do you have a comment on that?
Susan Kuttner, what do we know about thermography?
Well, thermography has been studied, and basically the idea of having a negative predictive value, you really want to see what the positive predictive value. And for thermography, there's no evidence to support its use as a screening tool. It has very poor cancer detection rates, so that it's really, unfortunately, not a good tool to be used.
We'll go to more calls, and we'll go to Mill Valley. Rick, you're on. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. I am a prostate cancer advocate at UCSF. I sit on a committee with Peter Carroll and others. I'm also a survivor. There are some real problems with the USPSTF recommendations. The first is that men, the way that the media has handled it, men are hearing that they should not get tested. They only need an excuse not to get tested. Men are not good about following up with medical tests anyway. And what they fail to point out is the test in and of itself is not harmful. The test is about information, not treatment. And what we need to do is to improve the way that the information that is produced by this test is handled. In other words, the information flow between the doctor and the patient once the results of the PSA test come forward. We don't have anything other than that PSA test. And if we don't screen, mass screen, then we are going to lose a lot of men who fall into the high-risk categories. And there's no question right now that the PSA test leads to a lot of overtreatment, but that's not the fault of the test. It's the fault of the way the information is handled. Second point I want to make is that the USPSTF recommendations completely ignore the interests of high-risk men. There are high-risk groups, for example, African-Americans or men who have hormonal cancers in their family. And there are high-risk men like myself. About 15% of all prostate cancer is intermediate or advanced. And those are the men who are highly at risk if we don't PSA test, because by the time this disease is symptomatic, it is generally too late to treat it. And those are the men who will die from the disease.
Rick, I thank you for those points. Dr. Gonzalo, want to come in?
No, I think these are excellent points to bring out with regard to the test. And while PSA in and of itself, as Susan had mentioned this earlier with respect to breast, is not necessarily a one-size-fits-all type of test, we know that it's clearly saving lives. Points are well taken with regard to men who harbor more intermediate or high-risk disease. And I think that there are actually some things that we can do above and beyond single individual PSA testing in terms of trying to better understand the significance of this test. You know, a lot of studies have come out, particularly from Johns Hopkins, Dr. Ballantyne Carter, who really believes that trying to not use PSA in and of itself with an absolute cutoff, and in fact try to target changes in PSA level over time, the so-called PSA velocity, may in fact give us a better indication or a better understanding of the presence or absence of a lethal cancer.
There is a lot of, we were talking about flux before, though, there's a lot of variation sometimes in PSA tests. I know friends of mine have had some real divergence in terms of their numbers.
No, absolutely. I mean, PSA, again, like I said, is not a perfect test. There are many conditions that can lead to either elevations or fluctuations within the test, infection, inflammation, you know, benign prostate disease, BPH, can certainly affect a number of things. And this is where that a very individualized, tailored approach and discussion with the physician on how best one might interpret the test will come into play. Certain PSA tests or levels, you know, in one individual who may be African American or who may have a family history of the disease may certainly be interpreted differently compared to a man with no risk factors for developing prostate cancer.
Jeff Balcoro, you had something you want to bring in?
Yeah, I want to applaud Rick. You know, this is a consumer revolution we're facing in healthcare, and patient advocates and other interested consumers like Rick are playing an extremely important role. I also just want to say that when someone says high risk, it's true. We need to be very careful about distinguishing the general screening for people who don't have risk factors. But always ask your doctor or anyone who's giving you this information, well, what does that really mean, high risk? And my understanding, and I'm happy to be corrected if I'm wrong, is that in the case of, say, prostate cancer, that number that I referred to goes from 3 out of 100 to about 5 out of 100 men will die in their lifetimes at lifetime risk of prostate cancer. So again, it's relatively higher than 3, but the improvements we're going to see with PSA or any other test are somewhat limited in absolute terms by the fact that it's still not a huge risk factor in over your lifetime.
Been talking a lot about risk, and we haven't broached the subject of cost, but here's a listener, Bradley, who writes actually, it's not Bradley. It's another listener named Chad from Livermore. Recently, my wife had a mammogram that led to a needle biopsy. We have private insurance, so it's not that great. The results were negative, thankfully, but our personal cost, over $7,000. Total bill, over $15,000. We couldn't not do it, but the price is way too high. Let me go to more of your calls, and we'll go next to San Francisco. Jennifer, hi. You're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to hear more about breast density. I've been hearing about how mammography might be ineffective for women with dense breasts, and I'd love to hear what women should do if they find out that they have dense breasts.
Susan Kudner?
Well, there has been a lot written about breast density as we learn more. Certainly, there was a recent article that also came out of UCSF that looked at the value added of the new digital mammography. At Kaiser, we are starting to have all of our mammography be transitioned into digital for a variety of reasons, one of which is its value added in younger women. And the issue about the 40 to 49-year-old women, why it's so much more difficult to detect early breast cancers, is because of the relative increased density in premenopausal women. So there is some value added in looking at digital mammography and breast density, but we still have a difficulty with evaluating the breast because it comes in all shapes and sizes, and we have not yet completely been able to quantify the level of density. We can look at what's a really fatty breast, which is the easiest to examine, and then we look at the extreme of the most dense. And in between, there's a lot of variability. So density of the breast is an emerging science that will help inform us once again about who should we continue to do mammograms on. If your mammogram looks like a polar bear in a snowstorm, is it any value to you to continue to do that? And if so, how often? So that's where, once again, personalized evaluation of what your prior exams have shown us tells us how often you should have them. And certainly, we're going to continue to evaluate digital technology to see if it shows us more, sort of like HDTV. You can now see everyone's wrinkles, but does that help you detect breast cancer any sooner? And I think in the recent studies, it shows in a small subset of population, it may be helpful.
Isn't there a lot of problem, though, with a certain amount of lumpiness in mammaries? I mean, the kind of thing that's often caused or thought to be caused, say, by methylxanthine, you know, different chemicals that create lumpiness that's even there to begin with, to start out. And that makes it even more hard to detect.
You know, certainly breast exam, you know, is one of the most difficult things on a physical exam as well as on any screening test because it comes in all shapes and sizes. And the lumpiness of a breast, which is very common in women, makes an exam imperfect. But it's also because breast cancer grows in a certain way so that the multiplying cells can be so microscopic that until they become the size that are detectable, you wouldn't be able to find such as a PSA test to be able to detect it before it started to grow. That's something that we need to start investigating, and we certainly need to start investigating how do we prevent this disease. And that's one of the things that I think we de-emphasize when we emphasize screening, and we certainly emphasize what we're investing in, the screening, very heavily rather than some of the issues about how can we decrease the risk of this disease.
Well, here's a listener, Marcia in Sacramento, who says, can you ask your guest to clarify or elaborate on the stories that came out in the last year about the lack of adequate maintenance on mammogram machines? I believe there was a fair amount of evidence that the radiation levels varied quite a lot depending on how leaky the machines were. And also, perhaps a two-pointed comment here, but women have said for years, if the test for prostate cancer involved a squeezing a body part between two plates of glass, the testing technology would have improved in a nanosecond. What about those mammogram machines, Susan Cutner?
Well, I think that one of the things that's really been very helpful is that we have federal law, the Medical Quality Standards Act, that has attempted to certify all mammography centers. And at Kaiser Permanente and most of the centers around the Bay Area, we do have mammograms that are tested on a regular basis. Certainly every X-ray exposure needs to have a quantification, and so there is a review of each X-ray machine to see that we're getting the best technical exams that we can with the least exposures. So I think that is an ongoing issue, that we have standards that are reviewed, and we do have outside reviewers that come and evaluate each center.
And that's industry-wide?
It is industry-wide for those centers that are part of the certification process. And in Kaiser Permanente, all of our centers are a part of this process.
I'm going to read an email here from a listener in Campbell named Rita. She says, how many other body parts do we irradiate every year? How many cancers are caused by cumulative radiation? We women line up for at least 4 blasts of radiation every 12 months. How about looking for better ways, improved ultrasound screening, for example? The breast cancer industry is large and lucrative. In my 40s, my doctor found a lump. First, I was scheduled for a special ultrasound. Next, a needle biopsy without finding any suspicious cells. The surgeon suggested to me that I could wait to see if the lump grows over time. Ha! At this time, I am now rapidly becoming a basket case. Finally, I have a biopsy in the hospital and was stunned to discover the surgeon removed a third of my breast and the results were all still negative. Surely we can find a better way to protect ourselves and our breasts. We'll go to another caller, and that's you. Barbara, hi.
Hi. I'm a 60-year-old woman. I've been unemployed for 2.5 years, so I haven't had health insurance. I was offered a free mammogram under the Every Woman Counts program, and I went through the same set of procedures that the woman whose email was read at the beginning of the program went through, and I am so grateful for all that discomfort because they found cancer. And next Wednesday, I go in to have the rims, the margins removed, and then I'll have 7 weeks of radiation. But because it was caught so early, I have a 90 to 95% chance of full recovery. I would go through that discomfort again in a heartbeat, and I'm urging all my friends not to skip their mammograms.
Thank you for that call. On the other side of things, though, Jeff Belcoro, we often hear about all these false positives and overdiagnoses, and the result is surgery, radiation, chemo, and, well, we've read a few nightmare scenarios here.
Yeah, you know, it's certainly true that overall screening, again, a general population that doesn't have symptoms or risk factors, is going to save a few lives. An earlier caller, and similar to this, to Barbara, talked about how she'd just been diagnosed and what would have happened if she hadn't been screened and caught. And, you know, the fact is that's not an easy answer to, question to answer, that there are certainly many tumors that are what Laura Esserman and others have started calling indolent or idle tumors. And so it's not necessarily true that without this early diagnosis, you know, you would be dead in a few years.
But forgive me, aren't there more overdiagnoses and problems resulting in treatment than lives being saved? Isn't it disproportionate, in fact?
Well, so I can try to explain that through an analogy with if you had two stadiums with 100,000 people filled in one stadium called Stadium X, X-ray machines, and another stadium, Stadium Y, not, and you were screening women in their 40s. At the end of 10 years, in Stadium Y, which is the one without screening, 25 women would have died from breast cancer. In Stadium X, with the X-rays, 20 would have died. So out of 100,000 people, you saved 5 lives. That's not negligible. I'm certainly not arguing that that's, you know, not a benefit. The issue is that we're also paying, many, many people are paying a price. And the caller, Barbara, just said she would happily pay that price. But there would be in Stadium X, 2,400 unnecessary extra imaging tests, 750 unnecessary biopsies, and 20 to 100 unnecessary treatments. That means people having surgeries and body parts removed and possibly radiation and chemotherapy and all that kind of thing. So it is a price that people pay, and that's why I think it should be an individual decision, you know, whether you want to start screening.
That's why I go back to the fact that it's a gamble. In fact, Mark Gonzalgo, it's even more, using the stadium metaphor that we just heard from Jeff Belcora, even more disproportionate for prostate cancer, isn't it? We have Mark?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, go ahead.
If you look at the number needed to treat in order to save one life from prostate cancer based on some of the large European studies, and again, remember, this is a number that's in flux. It can range anywhere from 1 out of 26 to 1 out of 40. This number may certainly be coming down in terms of, again, the number of men that will benefit from treatment in terms of their life being saved. I mean, I think there's emerging data, unfortunately, that obviously was not considered very highly by the U.S. Preventive Task Force with regard to the very large European randomized trials where almost 200,000 men were assigned to either a screening group versus not screening group. And this study conclusively showed that there was a 20% reduction in prostate cancer deaths among men who had PSA testing compared to those that were not tested at 9 years of follow-up. So I think that, certainly lives are being saved. There is and there exist risks of overtreatment, but even as, Jeff had alluded to, that one life saved, I think, again, our earlier callers is a great example, I think, shows the benefit of screening and testing.
And Maria Lena, you're on forum. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, Mike. I'm a big fan. This topic is near and dear to my heart because I feel like I've been spared. I dodged a bullet. I was telling my family recently. I went in for a routine mammogram that was a little overdue due to some other family health issues that had caused us a lot of stress. Thankfully, those got resolved, and I knew something was wrong, not because I had been doing DSCs or not because I'd skipped any mammograms, but I just knew in my body I was wrong. I'm 52 years old, and I have 2 teenage children and very happily married in a stable, stable relationship. That mammogram saved my life because it turns out that I did have 2 sites with ductal carcinoma, one of which had become infiltrating, and although I could have chosen to have a lumpectomy and had very medium results. I did a lot of research. I queried my doctors at Palo Alto Medical Foundation, who was phenomenal, by the way, very extensively. I read and read and read and asked questions of myself, my family, and overall. Basically, I became a very active consumer, and I really decided that this was going to have to be an individualized program, as Susan has said, and as Barbara has said, I'm gratefully go through those needle biopsies again and everything else. I had a skin-sparing mastectomy last Thursday, and they took 6 lymph nodes because they were all clustered. And thankfully, so far, we have to wait for the final path report, but it looks like they caught them all.
Well, we hope indeed that you have, but you are kind of a model for what we've been talking about here in terms of patient involvement and patient activism. Susan Kuttner? Yeah.
Well, I think that you're also a great example of why we need to look at not just mortality statistics. It's also how do we develop treatments that are appropriate to what we find, and how do we tailor that to the individual? So it's really a continuum. The screening is not an isolated process. And so we talk about saving lives. in breast cancer, we also want to save breasts if we can. We also want to look at decreasing the amount of treatments that we have that have long-term effects, like chemotherapy and some of the other treatments that we use, such as radiation therapy, that we want to use those tools well. So it's really a whole part of the continuum of care. We want to diagnose people appropriately. We want to treat them appropriately, because really what we're trying to do is improve the quality and the quantity of people's lives. And that's what all the screening is really about.
Same principles apply, Mark Gonzalgo, with prostate cancer?
Absolutely. Again, I think one of the common themes for this morning is really that individualized approach and that shared discussion between patient and physician. We have a lot of information that's out there that patients are have easy access to on the web, a lot of so-called nomograms, decision-making tools, and I think the data certainly is clear that there's a life-saving benefit from screening, but we have a lot of work to do. We need to develop more tests, and certainly, hopefully, at some point, we'll be able to refine this whole debate.
And Annie joins us as our next caller from Boston. Hi, Annie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a quick question about thermography, which I haven't heard mentioned. My understanding.
Oh, we talked about it earlier on in the program.
Okay, I had asked them. I missed it early on. I only picked up later in the show. So I don't know if you want to bring it up again, but just that it's, you know, there's no radiation involved. They seem to be able to detect cancerous cells so much earlier than what would be found on a mammogram.
Yeah, but I think we heard from Laura, from Susan Kuttner, excuse me, that it's not necessarily the panacea that maybe some would hope for. And I think that epitomizes it, doesn't it, Dr. Kuttner?
Well, I think that thermography is one of those tools, and we have others that we've looked at for screening tools. And we look at the combination of can they predict cancer, and thermography does not have a very good track record on being able to predict cancer as well as mammography. Certainly, we looked at other tools like ultrasound, and also, once again, not as good of a combination of specificity and that gives us the information that we need. So thermography really has not been proven in a number of cases to really detect cancer in a large group of women. And unfortunately, we have not yet found a non-X-ray tool.
Well, detecting cancer has been what we've really been all about this hour. To screen or not to screen, well, I think the answer that's come across here, the major motif, is be as informed as you possibly can and take responsibility as a consumer as much as you can, and with your doctor, physician, maybe even physicians, decide. Thank you for being with us. Jeff Belcura, again, you can go to his blog, jeffbelcura.com/blog. He also recommended, what was the book you recommended again?
Oh, Should I Be Tested for Cancer by Gil Welch.
Thank you for joining us. Thanks to Susan Kuttner, also of Kaiser, Jeff Belcura's UCSF, Mark Gonzalgo of Stanford, and thanks to Richard Knox of NPR. Thanks to you, our listeners. Another hour ahead, we're going to talk with Stephen Mitchell about translations and spirituality and much more. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.